to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Good morning and welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and today's episode is titled Ethics. From a spiritual perspective, how we act and how we treat our fellow man is surely the single most important thing in our life. But living a moral life is not as easy as it might seem. We live in a materially oriented world where we value status, wealth, and prestige over kindness and caring for others. If we're ever to break this cycle of always wanting more, we need to understand the negative impact it has on us and society in general. Our guest today is Peter Singer, who is one of the great moral inspirational forces of our time. Peter Singer is often described as the world's most influential living philosopher. In 2005, Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He is especially known for his work on the ethics of the treatment of animals, for his controversial critique of the sanctity of life in bioethics, and for his writing on the obligations of the affluent to aid those living in extreme poverty. He first became well known internationally after the publication of Animal Liberation in 1975. In 2011, Time included Animal Liberation on its all-time list of 100 best nonfiction books published in England, in English, since the magazine began in 1923. Mr. Singer has written, co-authored, edited, or co-edited more than 40 books, including Practical Ethics, The Expanding Circle, and most recently, The Most Good You Can Do. His works have appeared in more than 25 languages. Since 1999, he has been the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. And since 2005, he has combined that position with the position of Laureate Professor at the University of Melbourne in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies. In 2012, he was made a Companion of the Order of Australia, the nation's highest civic honor. Peter Singer, welcome to the show, Peter. It's a great honor to have you with us today.
Thank you, David. It's very good to be with you.
Now, you've been encouraging the world to improve their moral behavior for a long time now. What got you started?
I suppose I started with myself. I had been interested in ethics and philosophy, and I just enjoyed talking about these big questions about what we ought to do and can ethical judgments be true or false. But in terms of, the way my career has gone and my interests that you mentioned in the introduction, the biggest change came when I was a graduate student in Oxford and I learned about the way we treat animals to produce their meat or eggs. In other words, I learned about factory farming, which this was in the early 1970s, was not at all known at the time. And I immediately thought, one can't really defend this way of keeping animals indoors, locked up, unable to satisfy their natural instincts or walk around in a field or anything like that, just so that we can get their meat or eggs a little bit cheaper. So that obviously led to a decision that this is not just a theoretical question, because I was buying these products every day. I was eating them every day, and that meant that I was supporting these practices. So I realized then that I had to change my life and that it would be important that this not just be a personal thing to keep my own soul pure, if you like, but that this was something that really needed to change as a whole. And therefore, there was a role for somebody to talk about the ethics of how we treat animals and to get involved in all of these questions about how we ought to live.
And that was back in the 70s, and people weren't talking that much about that back then. So it was... Some of your ideas were pretty revolutionary to everybody, really, and And I know a lot of people are intimidated by philosophy, and I suspect some of my listeners are as well. So I wanted to show how a plain and straightforward a philosophical argument can be. So I want to talk about your over 40 years ago you put out an article which you recently I think has turned into a book called Famine, Affluence, and Morality, and it had three main points. And let me just run through those points to show people how clear and you know, you don't have to have five volumes to have a philosophical argument. So let me see if I get this right. You check me out.
Good.
Point number one, suffering and death from lack of food, health care, and or shelter is bad. Point one. Point two, if it is within our power to prevent this from happening without sacrificing something with an equivalent moral importance, then we should do it. And point three, our society has the ability and tools readily available to eradicate famine, so we each have a moral obligation to give whatever excess wealth we have to this cause. Did I get it right?
Yes, you certainly did get it right. And I think it is a pretty straightforward argument. And I've been very pleased that that has been taken up. You know, that article, as you said, appeared in the early 1970s, one of the first pieces I published in a philosophical journal. But it didn't just stay in the philosophical journals. It got reprinted in a lot of readers and anthologies that hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions by now, of undergraduates have read. So they've confronted the ideas in their classes, and their professors have talked about them and debated them. And now, as you say, it's just been published as a little book by Oxford University Press, with a couple of other writings of mine. So it's getting around, and it's helped to trigger this new movement called effective altruism, which is about how each of us can not just donate some of our wealth, as you mentioned in that summary, but can find the most effective charities in order to donate it to, so that we really know that it's getting to the people who need it and doing the most good it can.
I loved it, the way it was short, to the point, and really, it's you know, it just seems intuitively obvious once you state it that way. You know, it was beautifully put. And you did this, must have been 45 years ago or something. It was you must have been a fairly young guy when you came
up
with
it. Yeah, 44 years ago it was published. So I was in my mid-20s. As I say, you know, you say it seems obvious, but a lot of people see ethics as just following the thou shalt not commandments. That is, you know, as long as you don't do certain bad things, which are listed, then you're living a good ethical life. And I think the world has changed. And now that we live in a world where there's such enormous differences in wealth and standards of living between different countries, and we have the ability to reach out to people and to help them in ways that we didn't have before, I think that to live an ethical life, it's not enough just to say, I don't do these bad things, but you actually also have to use your abilities and your resources, whatever they are, to try to make the world a better place too.
You know, and I think you're absolutely right. And I think the more you get into ethics and the more you think about it, and you've thought a lot about it, you spend your life at it, it's a pretty sophisticated subject. You know, it's not intuitively obvious, you know, what is right and what is wrong. It, you know, you say, well, you know, it's not right to kill somebody, and that most people would agree with. But then you say, well, you know, the obvious, how about a soldier? Well, you know, okay, there's a circumstance. It's not right to steal, but, you know, how about Les Mis, right? The guy goes and steals a loaf of bread to feed a starving child. Every time you say something, it just peels, you know, it's like peeling a layer of onion back. It's a fascinating topic, I think.
It is, that's right. And we tend to think in these rather short sorts of moral rules, as you say, about, well, you know, you shouldn't kill or you shouldn't steal. But those things do break down once you start to look at particular cases. And that'll be true of almost anything. You know, you say, keep your promises, but what if you've promised to meet somebody at a certain time and then you, as you're getting there, there's a road accident and you can save somebody's life by taking them to hospital, but you break your promise. Obviously, everybody would agree that you shouldn't keep the promise in those cases. But exactly where these exceptions are and how they should be discussed, that's a really big area. And a lot of what I do is trying to tease out some of these exceptions and differences to what most people take as moral rules.
You know, and that's, and I love the way you said it, tease it out, because what you're really trying to do is you're trying to get people think about it. To, you know, you're not saying, hey, this is the answer necessarily. It's just, it's a lot deeper and more complicated than maybe we're looking at, and you got to look at it another level down.
And yeah, exactly.
And maybe a whole bunch of levels down.
yeah, maybe. And a lot of people don't understand that that's what philosophy does. You know, when I was appointed to Princeton in 1999, there were a lot of protests because of my views about abortion and euthanasia, which were certainly controversial. And I got letters saying, and the president of Princeton got letters saying, you know, this person is going to be indoctrinating our children, our students. You know, we don't want them to be indoctrinated in this way. But that's a complete misunderstanding of what you do in a philosophy class, because you put ideas out there, but you also give the students reading to of people who argue against those views. Or in my case, for example, when I talk about abortion, I have a professor of Christian ethics from Fordham University, a Catholic university, to come and talk to the class about his views on that topic. So we are trying to get students to think and to look at the arguments on both sides and to make up their own minds in the end as to how they see these issues.
Yeah. Now you started out and you took on famine as one of your big arguments. And I know you did animal rights and many other things too as you went along. But famine is an interesting one. And I assume when you talk about famine, you're really talking about, you know, poverty in general, because famine is the extreme. And I think we've done in the industrial world, not counting Syria and what we've done to ourselves here, but mankind is making a lot of progress in the industrial world with famine. But I don't think we've done a particularly good job eliminating misery, especially if you look at the urban areas, if you will. And we have a situation where certainly we can't dictate how people will end up in life, because there's just too many variables between hard work and commitment, and capability, and maybe luck or whatever. But we should be able to help people start out at the same. In other words, with a good education and safe neighborhoods, equal opportunity to move forward. Have you ever delved into that and come up with any ideas on you know, ways that we might be able to improve that lot in life for people?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about the industrialized countries now, that is, as you say, a really difficult question, because I think it's one thing to say everybody should be able to have the basics. So everybody should be able to have enough to eat. They should be able to have a minimum of health care. They should have some decent housing that protects them from the elements. And you mentioned education. And, of course, they should have access to a decent level of education for their children. So those are basics that I think the state can and should provide. And in most industrialized nations, the state does provide that at a reasonable level. When you talk about security and safety in your neighborhood, that clearly gets more difficult. And there are questions about what is going on there and how costly is it to provide that? Can you provide that in every area? We certainly should be trying, but we do have limited resources, and at some point, tough decisions have to be made as to what you prioritize. And my view is, you know, you ought to be prioritizing so as to get the best value for the money you're spending. So that will mean maybe some areas rather than others, the ones that you can more easily provide everyone with rather than the ones that are very difficult?
I wonder, money certainly helps, but I'm not sure money is the end all answer. I mean, you're down in Australia now, and I'm not sure you've read the U.S. news, but we had a situation in Flint, Michigan with the water source. Are you familiar with that?
I am. Yeah. I keep up with the U.S. news when I'm
okay. I mean, you know, when you think about it, that had nothing to do with water, with money, really. You know, and here was these supposedly well-intentioned government workers and regulators, and not one or two of them, but a whole group of them making these decisions. It kind of blows you away that they can make these decisions, knowing the problems that they're putting on people, and from a money perspective, that. I don't know where money gets us out of that. And then you look at, you know, people like Paul Theroux. You probably know of him anyway. You may know him. And he did a lot of traveling and living and working in Africa. And he felt that our donations for many of the African countries just seemed to encourage governmental graft and a dependence of the people on meager handouts rather than taking care of themselves. And he will argue that, you know, not that we haven't done any good, but that he's not sure we aren't doing more harm than good, you know, with putting money in those type of situations. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think there's undoubtedly the potential for money to get wasted and for bad government to cause a lot of problems, whether it's in Flint or whether it's in Africa. So I think we have to be very careful about what we're doing. I certainly agree with Paul Theroux about that, and I would not disagree with him that a lot of aid has been wasted in the past. But that's why, as I said earlier, there is this new movement known as effective altruism, which relies on doing really thorough research into what organizations are doing and what's happening to it and what the impact actually is on the ground. So I am certainly not advocating that we just hand over sums of money to governments in Africa. I'm rather thinking of programs that are organizing things that are happening where you can follow it up. So you have something like the Against Malaria Fund, which is distributing bed nets against malaria. And so they're going into countries with obviously the cooperation of the government, but they're actually, their people are distributing the bed nets. They're educating people in how to use them and why they're important. They follow up sometime later to check that the bed nets are being used properly. You know, when you get charities like that that are really careful and transparent in everything that they're doing and quite open to you, everybody having a look, then I don't think we have the same problem of just throwing money at problems without really seeing whether it's doing any good.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think sometimes we have a tendency, we in the industrialized world, to, you know, we know about these problems and we think, okay, I'll feel good about myself if I give $100 or $1,000 or whatever the number is to a charity, and really not understanding what that charity is doing and how they're operating. And I think that's one thing that I think we need to hold some of the charities to a higher standard and say, hey, you know, give us some feedback. You know, what's happening here? And because we really do want, well, it's more than you know, something for our buck. It's we want to solve a problem. We want to help somebody, and we need to make sure that we're doing it effectively.
Yeah, and fortunately now we have organizations that are doing that research for us. So it would be very difficult for any individual to do it. But if you go to a website, for example, like The Life You Can Save, which is an organization that takes its name from a book that I wrote a few years ago, and you can go there and you can click on where to donate, and you can find a list of charities that have been thoroughly studied, not just in the sense of, you know, how are their, what are their financials, how much of their money is going to administration and how much of the programs, but also very importantly, what are the programs actually doing? How much good are they doing? And you can find a choice of, 15 or 18 different charities that have been carefully assessed and rated there. And you can give with confidence to those charities. And there are other groups. There's GiveWell that's also doing the same thing. So, yeah, it's possible now to have a good basis of knowledge that has been there for a few years and know that you're avoiding the problems that Paul Thoreau talks about.
Yeah. Okay. And that's great. That's good to know. Now, let me get a little philosophical with you and throw out one. Why does it matter? Why do we care? I mean, if we're an atheist and we believe that life has no purpose but to live and die, you know, should an atheist care about morality and helping other people? Or do you have to be a spiritual or religious person to care? What do you think?
I certainly don't think you have to be a theist to care. I mean, whether you have to have, you know, some spirituality depends obviously on what you mean by spirituality. I've been noticing that in the election campaign, when Bernie Sanders gets asked about religion or spirituality or something like that, he turns it to saying that his spirituality is to try to make sure that everyone can have a decent chance in life and live a good life and so on. So he sees the spiritual side of his nature as trying to make the world a better place. And I certainly think that you don't need to believe in God to want to do that. You said a moment ago that an atheist doesn't think there's any purpose in the world except to live or die. I mean, that's true in a sense that there's no overriding purpose. An atheist won't think that the world was created for some purpose by a divine creator. But an atheist will certainly be able to say that there are purposes that we have in the world, that the world will be a better place if people are able to live and die enjoying their lives without suffering, without the various kinds of agony that can take place. And therefore, we do all have purposes in the world because we can all make a difference, whether a small difference locally to the people we know or a larger difference to people far away from us or to animals. We can all make a difference in making the world a better place for all of the beings, human and non-human animals, who live in it.
Do you think then that we are born with a certain morality, if you will, that, you know, whatever we believe, we still believe in helping our fellow man? You think that's innate?
So I think it's complicated. As you said, ethics does tend to be complicated. I think we're all born, when I say all, I mean, I guess there may be some really abnormal people, some extreme psychopaths or something like that. But basically, right, I think most of us are born with a tendency to want to help others, a sort of positive social benevolence towards others. But that can certainly turn, particularly if we feel that others are hostile to us or are doing something bad to us, well, badly intentioned to us. So I would say that it's going to vary with the circumstances. Circumstances will play a big role in this. And it's also, I think it's, you know, what we're born with tends to be, we were talking earlier about people thinking that morality consists of rather simple rules like do not kill, do not steal, and so on. So I think we're born with some biases towards certain kinds of reactions. You could say certain kinds of yuck feelings. So if somebody describes something to us, we have this kind of yuck reaction, which I think is in many cases innate. But we also have this capacity to think and reason. And sometimes that's going to conflict. So sometimes we might have a kind of yuck response to something, but then we'll say, oh, but in this case, really, that's different. So what's happening is not a bad thing. We might change our attitudes as a result of thinking. So I think, yes, some aspects of our ethics are innate, but other aspects are not and can be affected either by our culture or by our capacities to think about the issues.
Yeah. Do you think if you talk to most people in the world, they would say that they are moral? And when I talk about most, I'm talking about the large, large percentage of people. You think people think that they personally act morally?
Yes, I think that most people do think that, and it's important for our self-esteem that we do think that. I think actually it's pretty destructive if you really think that by your own values you're a bad person, and that's one of the things which is why it's really important to practice to live ethically, and to help others, because it actually is rewarding. It's rewarding for yourself as well as for others. But although, as I say, most people do think that they're ethical people, I think that often they're not applying the best standards. So as we were saying before, they may think that to live ethically it's enough just to obey these thou shalt nots. They may not think about what they're eating, for example. They live in a society where people just buy whatever's down at the supermarket that's cheap. They don't really think about how the animals that they're purchasing to eat were raised. So that doesn't get into their kind of moral sense of whether they're living ethically or not. And something of the same may be true to whether they're doing anything to help people in extreme poverty. So, people will tend to think they live ethically, but I think they need to think a bit harder about some of the standards that they're taking for granted.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I could take your point even further and say terrorists will tell you, if you went and talked to a terrorist, I would say that most of them, maybe all of them, will say, yeah, I'm acting morally. These are my morals. What do you think?
Well, certainly. I mean, some of them, after all, are sacrificing their lives, right, and knowing that they're sacrificing their lives for what they see as the right thing to do. And I think this is a real challenge to people who think that religious faith is in itself a good thing. Because religious faith can be used in such terrible ways. It would be very hard to say that the terrorists who sacrificed their lives to bring down the World Trade Center did not have strong religious faith. It seems to me clear that they did. So that's why we really need to not just have that faith in something that we're taught or brought up with or in some book that we take to be holy, but actually really think critically for ourselves about the basis of our actions. That's what's lacking, of course, in people who do these terrible things.
So I guess what we're saying is morality is not really an individual's prerogative. Morality is really something that society needs to look at, and ethical standards are not something that an individual can go off and just say, hey, I think this is, this is the right way to live.
And Bo already in on a shot here.
You really need,
has Martin up
really
in the air.
There's
trying to fight it
a
off.
Standard that's
elbow deep locked here
this,
for Nickel.
And it may be a very
comes up around the waist and scores the first takedown.
But there is something that if we looked at it, and if we went
Martin
through
to
it,
his feet
there
and cuts away for one, so 2-1 now
in favor of Nickel. Say, yeah, these are our standards, and be an ethical standard from society as opposed to an individual who might be a terrorist and might believe some God wants him to do something. So you're basically saying, and I think I'm saying, that this is really a societal. Set of standards that we're looking for to come to grips with.
Yeah, in fact, I would go further because you said mankind at one point, and you also said society. Some people think that ethics is relative to your culture, so that if your society tells you to do something, that's what you ought to do. But I think we realize now that can't really be correct. I mean, you might live in the territory that is now ruled by ISIS, the Islamic State, and maybe in that society it tells you to do all sorts of things. For example, seems like if there's a woman from a group who's a heretic, it's okay to basically make her your sexual slave. So the fact that that's approved of in that culture, then we don't think that that makes it right, and we don't think that people are justified in acting that way. So we have to get beyond particular cultures, and we have to really try to think of more universal principles. And I think there are such universal principles, and I think we find them in, not absolutely all, but most of the cultures that have long ethical traditions and thinkers, whether you call them philosophers or not, who've discussed those, and those are both Western and Eastern cultures. And they do seem to agree on the idea, for example, of putting yourself in the place of others and asking yourself, what would it be like if I were in their situation? Of course, this is familiar to people in the Jewish and Christian traditions through the idea of the Golden Rule. But you also find it in the teachings of Confucius and in the Sanskrit early epics like the Mahabharata. So it seems that this is something that actually transcends cultures and transcends particular societies, that when people think about ethics, they can think about this idea of a kind of impartial concern for everyone that I think is an underlying basis for ethics.
Yeah, you see, I agree 100%. And I look at it and I state it, selfless service to others. And I agree with you, Christ and Buddha and Krishna and all the great teachers all seem to boil down to the way that we should judge our own actions is, are they selfless? Are we selflessly serving others? And, you know, that's an incredibly difficult standard to live by, especially in our world and the level that our society and world has matured to. And I do think we are maturing and evolving. But if we looked at it and we said, all right, let's use that as maybe our goal, maybe our long-term goal. And maybe we can't be there right now. But when we're making a decision, if we could look at it, and it just kind of goes back to your effective altruism, because altruism and selflessness are about the same thing. If we could look at it and judge what we do in our actions and how we decide how to treat people from a selfless service to others, that might be at least a direction that we could go to help us work our way through some of these complicated problems.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that, certainly in terms of helping others and the universality of that in different traditions. I wouldn't put the same emphasis you did on selfless, because I think that may be too demanding. And you might be surprised that I say that, because as you read from that article, Famine, Affluence, and Morality, I do have a pretty high demanding standard. But I think that we all need to get satisfaction and fulfillment out of our own lives. And I think we can do that through living ethically, through, as I said, living in accordance with our own values. And so it can be rewarding for us as well. Your listeners who are interested in this might like to look at the blog of a woman called Julia Wise, who lives in Boston and came to effective altruism as a way of living, even as a child, when she realized that there were some people in the world who had so much less than she did. And she has a blog online called Giving Gladly. So you can find it at givinggladly.com, I think it is. And Julia Wise writes about how it's much more fulfilling. She and her husband give away a very substantial part of their income. I think it's now up to about half of their income that they're giving to effective charities. But she says, when I consider my life and what I could do with this money, yes, I could have a materially more comfortable life. I could buy various consumer goods with it. But when I compare the enjoyment and fulfillment that I might get from that with what I get from knowing that I'm helping these wonderful charities and the people who are being helped by them, she says she gets incomparably more satisfaction out of that. So, that's what I meant by saying you don't have to think of it as a sacrifice. You can think of it as actually being internally rewarding, while at the same time you certainly are doing good for the world and helping others.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that 100%. I think you're absolutely right. Can you teach ethics? Can you teach people to act morally?
Well, I certainly hope so, because that's what I spend a lot of my time doing. Although, as I said, I'm trying to teach them to think about ethics. I'm not trying to indoctrinate them into doing what I think is right. But I do that at least in part because I hope that by thinking more clearly about ethics, they will end up living more ethically. And I know that I have some success in that. It's hard to say exactly how much. I sometimes teach quite large classes in the fall semester, for instance. I taught a class of 250. And I know that some of those people will be changed in the way they live, because each year when I've taught that class before, I get letters back sometimes years later saying, I'm now doing this or that, and your class helped me to think about what I wanted to do in my life. So, yeah, we can certainly influence a significant number of people to live more ethically, maybe not everyone. And you know, that does change lives in a really important way. And I find it very exciting that philosophy actually does change lives, because, as you said at the beginning of this discussion, a lot of people think of philosophy as something, you know, very deep. You're going to have to read lots of dense volumes, and does it all make any difference in the end? But I can say from my experience, the answer is clearly yes. It makes a difference to what people eat. That's a very concrete, practical thing. It makes a difference to what they do with their money, or with some of their money. That's another concrete thing. And I even have had somebody who read that article that we were talking about, Famine, Affluence, and Morality, in a class, got into a discussion, and ended up donating a kidney to a stranger in a hospital because he realized that that person had a greater need for it than he had, that you can do okay with one kidney. So, you know, that's a
great
story. Extraordinary. Yeah. It's an intimate personal decision that you would allow a part of your body to be removed and given to a stranger as a result of a philosophy class.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, you know, I'm not sure that you can teach somebody the desire to act virtuously. I think maybe that comes from within. But you certainly can teach them what constitutes a virtuous action. And I think if people were aware of what is moral and what isn't moral, and the more they thought about it, I think most people would just start acting a little bit more morally correct just because they realized what the situation was.
Yes, I think that's true. And in terms of it coming from within, you may be right about that, but it's very easy for people in this society to just go along with some track that is sort of laid down for them, to follow what their friends are doing, to not think very much, and to end up with a life that perhaps, you know, isn't even the best for them, as well as not doing the most good. So one of the people I mentioned, this organization, The Life You Can Save, which spun off the book that I wrote with that title, and is now doing research recommending effective charities and promoting the idea of helping the poor. So the executive director of that, who I might mention, is unpaid. In fact, I tell him he's on negative salary because he donates to the organization without taking any salary from it. So he's somebody who, when he was an undergraduate, which was in the 70s, had sort of ideas about improving the world, but then gradually slipped into a career where he ended up being the president of a major men's clothing retail chain. And so he made a lot of money and was living quite comfortably, but had this somewhat uncomfortable feeling that he wasn't really doing what he'd set out to do with his life. And when he got to around 60 or something, he thought, you know, well, he read that book, The Life You Can Save, and he thought, maybe, you know, I've still got time to make a bigger difference. So he contacted me and he said, can I help? And, you know, with his background in retail selling and so on, I thought, yes, this is a great person to actually help to promote this idea. And he's now doing that. And he says, you know, The Life You Can Save was my own in his case. So I think people sometimes need to be prodded or jolted out of a kind of complacency about where their lives can go. That is, you know, clearly, in one sense, he was leading a very successful life as being president of this national chain. But in another sense, it wasn't really successful by the standards that he had deep inside him.
Yeah. Now who's responsible for teaching ethics in our society? Is it the parents? Is it the churches? Is it the schools? Who's responsible?
It's clearly all of the above, and that's good. That's necessary because sometimes one of those groups that you mentioned isn't there or fails. We all know that there are parents. Most parents do bring up their children to be ethical, but we all know that there are family breakdowns and parents that fail to do that. Schools can play an important role, certainly, and should play an important role. And I'd like to see actually more explicit discussion of ethics, and I emphasize again discussion, not indoctrination, in schools. And I've noticed that, especially in high school, there is now there are more classes in philosophy and in ethics. I get students coming up to Princeton who've already taken ethics classes and read some of my work in those classes before they get there. So I think that's a good thing.
Where should it start, Peter? How low in school should it go?
Yeah, I think it can start in elementary school. There is a movement called Philosophy for Children, which has promoted suitable reading for the discussion of ethical issues and philosophical questions for elementary school children, because children have this natural curiosity. I mean, I don't know if you're a parent. I am, but my children asking these why questions all the time, right? They would say why, and you would give them some answer, and then they would say, but why? And, after a while, most parents probably just get fed up, and they say, just because you can't keep. But they're really trying to get to the bottom of something when kids ask those why questions. And we should give them opportunities to ask them and try not to shut them off as much as we can. So, you can do that in elementary school, but it takes a certain skill and a certain ability, and I think it hasn't really spread as much as it should have because it is innovative and it would require retraining elementary school teachers to do more of this. But certainly it can be done in junior high and at other levels above that.
See, I'm kind of an extremist on this, I guess, and I think it should start as early as they're talking, the nursery school. And I think I'd like to see a curriculum of basically discussions of this type of things, just to get them thinking about it all the way through elementary school, all the way through high school. I think in college it ought to be, it's like reading and writing and arithmetic to me. It's something that is so complicated and requires so much thought and sophistication, because it shouldn't stop. It should go through the trade schools. It should go through the professional schools like legal and medical and business schools. I was out and I was a businessman and I started out as an engineer and I was a businessman and I created a company. And the issues that are dropped on your plate, at 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon or whenever, and all of a sudden you have to make, whether it's a pricing issue or whether, it's very sophisticated, the problems that we run into in the world that we live in. Doctors are forever deciding, should this person live or die, and what kind of pain medicine should I give them, and then the lawyers are saying, well, should I represent somebody that I know is a felon and try to get them off on a technicality? It goes forever, as you know that as well as anybody in the world, and it just seems to me that it's such an important topic that we're letting it go. And trying to hit it with a class here and a class there instead of a focus and something that says, because you're absolutely right. What you give is you get it back. What you give out to other people, it comes back to you in many, many ways. And we just it seems to me we need to put a greater focus on it all the way up and down the line.
Yeah, I think we do, but I do see some signs of that happening. I certainly get a lot of invitations to speak at meetings of people in business and in other areas where ethics is relevant. I spoke in the fall at a meeting of fiduciary investors, that is people who are managing funds for other investors. I think, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was some enormous, like $6 trillion worth of funds that were represented by people in the room. It was just staggering. And they were there to talk about ethics of investing. There was a discussion, for example, about should we stop investing in fossil fuels and particularly in coal because of its contribution to climate change. I mean, we might make a little more money from the investment perhaps if we're in it, but if we're actually producing a world that's going to be worse for everyone, including our investors, are we doing them any good? So we are getting more of these questions and discussions coming up, and I think that's definitely to be welcome.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Well, we're beginning to run out of time, and I have all kinds of interesting things to ask you about animal rights and all kinds of things, and we're not going to get into those today, unfortunately. But maybe you can tell, you know, our listeners some of the things that you're doing and how they can get in touch with you or find out about things about what you're doing.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I suppose, you know, my two major focuses in terms of what people can do and how to live have been to do with global poverty and with the treatment of animals. And I think they're both really important issues. We've talked a bit about both of them. In terms of helping people in extreme poverty, the best way to get involved in that is to go to the website of The Life You Can Save, thelifeyoucansave.org, and look at that. You can get lots of information. You can sign up for the newsletter. You can follow other leads about what you can do there. In terms of animals, I think one of the most important things that you can do is to think about what you're eating, because that's the way in which we're now contributing to an immense universe of suffering, of literally billions of animals each year in the United States alone going through intensive confinement, essentially being treated as cogs in machines to make money rather than as animals, as sentient beings with lives of their own to live. And I think we are making progress on these issues. And I think when Americans get a chance to vote on them, as, for example, Californians did in 2008, there was a citizens' initiative, a ballot about whether animals could be kept in cages so small that they can't move or stretch their limbs without bumping up against the sides of the cage or another animal in it. And that's standard for factory farm animals. And Californians voted by over 60% against that. And California now does not allow those kinds of farming. But other states, unfortunately, do, and people support it. So there, again, you can find effective charities. There's a website called Animal Charity Evaluators that will give you which are the most effective animal charities that are worth supporting. And there's a lot of good organizations out there. And, of course, as I say, changing your own diet here is one of the important things to do.
Well, I want to thank you for the fantastic work you've done and are doing to aid humanity and really life in general. And I'm quite frankly, when I think of humanity, I put the animals in that category. And you've done fantastic things. I want to thank you for that, and thank you so much for being on the show today, Peter Singer.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you and with your audience. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's and other shows will be posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section on my website, and I'll publish those answers for you as well. Also, I cover all these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. we all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You're a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.